She could see Dunworthy's feet. He was wearing shapeless leather shoes, the kind that had made the footprint. She tried to say something about the shoes, to ask him whether Mr. Gilchrist had made him put on authentic medieval dress just to come and fetch her, but the light's movement was making her dizzy again. She closed her eyes, and when she opened them again, he was kneeling in front of her. He had set the lantern down, and the light lit the hood of his cloak and folded hands. "It's all right," she said. "I know you were worried, but I'm all right, truly. I just felt a little ill."
He raised his head.
"Certes, it had been the loose to dias for got for to gestis hisantis imala,"
he said. He had a hard, lined face, a cruel face, a cutthroat's face. He had watched her lying there, and then he had gone away and waited for it to get dark, and now he'd come back. Kivrin tried to put up a hand to fend him off, but her hands had got tangled somehow in the cloak. "Go away," she said, her teeth chattering so hard she couldn't get the words out. "Go away." He said something else, with a rising inflection this time, a question. She couldn't understand what he was saying. "It's Middle English," she thought. "I studied it for 3 years, and Mr. Latimer taught me everything there is to know about adjectival inflection. I should be able to understand it. It's the fever," she thought. "That's why I can't make out what he's saying."
He repeated the question, or asked some other question. She couldn't even tell that much.
"It's because I'm ill," she thought. "I can't understand him because I'm ill." "Kind sir," she began,
but she could not remember the rest of the speech.
"Help me," she said, and tried to think how to say that in Middle English. But she couldn't remember anything but the church Latin. "Domine ad adjuvandum me festina," she said.
He bowed his head over his hands and began to murmur so low she could not hear. And then she must have lost consciousness again, because he had picked her up and was carrying her. She could still hear the jangling sound of the bells from the open net, and she tried to tell what direction they were coming from, but her teeth were chattering so hard she couldn't hear.
"I'm ill," she said,
as he set her on the white horse. She fell forward, clutching at the horse's mane to keep from falling off. He put his hand up to her side and held her there.
"I don't know how this happened. I had all my inoculations."
He led the donkey off slowly. The bells on its bridle jingled tinnily. Transcript from the Doomsday Book.
"Mr. Dunworthy, I think you'd better come and get me."
Chapter 7. "I knew it," Mrs. Gadsden said, steaming down the corridor toward them. "He's contracted some horrible disease, hasn't he? It's all that rowing." Mary stepped forward.
"You can't come in here," she said. "This is an isolation area."
Mrs. Gadsden kept coming. The transparent poncho she was wearing over her coat threw off large, spattering drops as she walked toward them, swinging the valise like a weapon.
"You can't put me off like that. I'm his mother. I demand to see him."
Mary put up her hand like a policeman.
"Stop,"
she said, in her best ward sister voice. Amazingly, Mrs. Gadsden stopped.
"A mother has a right to see her son," she said. Her expression softened. "Is he very ill?"
"If you mean your son William, he's not ill at all," Mary said. "At least, so far as I know." She put her hand up again. "Please don't come any closer. Why do you think William's ill?"
"I knew it the moment I heard about the quarantine. A sharp pain went through me when the station master said, 'Temp quarantine.'"
She set down the valise so she could indicate the location of the sharp pain.
It's because he didn't take his vitamins. I asked the college to be sure to give them to him, she said, shooting a glance at Dunworthy that was the rival of any of Gilchrist. And they said he was able to take care of himself. Well, obviously, they were wrong. William is not the reason the temp quarantine was called. One of the university techs has come down with a viral infection, Mary said. Dunworthy noticed gratefully that she didn't say Balliol's tech. The tech is the only case, and there is no indication that there will be any others, Mary said. The quarantine is a purely precautionary measure, I assure you. Mrs. Gadsden didn't look convinced. My Willie's always been sickly, and he simply will not take care of himself. He studies far too hard in that draughty room of his, she said with another dark look at Dunworthy. I'm surprised he hasn't come down with a viral infection before this. Mary took her hand down and put it in the pocket she carried her bleeper in. I do hope she's calling for help, Dunworthy thought. By the end of one term at Balliol, Willie's health was completely broken down, and then his tutor forced him to stay up over Christmas and read Petrarch, Mrs. Gadsden said. That's why I came up. The thought of him all alone in this horrid place for Christmas, eating heaven knows what and doing all sorts of things to endanger his health, was something this mother's heart could simply not bear. She pointed to the place where the pain had gone through her at the words temp quarantine. And it is positively providential that I came when I did. Positively providential. I nearly missed the train. My valise was so cumbersome, and I almost thought, ah, well, there'll be another along. But I wanted to get to my Willie, so I shouted at them to hold the doors, and I hadn't so much as stepped off at Cornmarket when the station master said, temp quarantine train service is temporarily suspended. Only just think, if I'd missed that train and taken the next one, I would have been stopped by the quarantine. Only just think. I'm sure William will be surprised to see you, Dunworthy said, hoping she would go find him. Yes, she said grimly. He's probably sitting there without even his muffler on. He'll get this viral infection, I know it. He gets everything. He used to break out in horrible rashes when he was little. He's bound to come down with it. At least his mother is here to nurse him through it. The door was flung open, and two people wearing masks, gowns, gloves, and some sort of paper covering over their shoes came racing through it. They slowed to a walk when they saw there was no one collapsed on the floor. I need this area cordoned off and an isolation ward sign posted, Mary said. She turned to Mrs. Gadsden. I'm afraid there's a possibility you've been exposed to the virus. We do not have a positive mode of transmission yet, and we can't rule out the possibility of its being airborne, she said. And for one horrible moment, Dunworthy thought she meant to put Mrs. Gadsden in the waiting room with them. Would you escort Mrs. Gadsden to an isolation cubicle? She asked one of the masked and gowned. We'll need to run blood tests and get a list of your contacts. Mr. Dunworthy, if you'll just come with me, she said, and led him into the waiting room and shut the door before Mrs. Gadsden could protest. They can keep her a while and give poor Willie a few last hours of freedom. That woman would make anyone break out in a rash, he said. Everyone except the medic had looked up at their entrance. Latimer was sitting patiently by the tray, his sleeve rolled up. Montoya was still using the phone. Colin's train was turned back, Mary said. He's safely at home by now. Oh, good, Montoya said, and put the phone down. Gilchrist leapt for it. Mr. Latimer, I'm sorry to keep you waiting, Mary said. She broke open a pair of imperm gloves, put them on, and began assembling a punch. Gilchrist here. I wish to speak with a senior tutor, Gilchrist said into the telephone. Yes. I'm trying to reach Mr. Basingham. Yes, I'll wait. The senior tutor has no idea where he is, Dunworthy thought,
and neither has the secretary.
He'd already spoken to them when he was trying to stop the drop. The secretary hadn't even known he was in Scotland.
I'm glad they found the kid, Montoya said, looking at her digital.
How long do you think they'll keep us here?
I gotta get back to my dig before it turns into a swamp. We're excavating Skengate's churchyard right now. Most of the graves date from the 1400s, but we've got some Black Deaths and a few pre-William the Conquerors. Last week we found a knight's tomb, beautiful condition. I wonder if Kivrin's there yet.
Dunworthy assumed she meant at the village and not in one of the graves.
I hope so, he said.
I told her to start recording her observations of Skengate immediately. The village and the church, especially the tomb. The inscription's partly worn off and some of the carving. The date's readable, though. 1318.
It's an emergency, Gilchrist said.
He fumed through a long pause.
I know he's fishing in Scotland. I want to know where.
Mary put a plaster on Latimer's arm and motioned to Gilchrist. He shook his head at her. She went over to the medic and shook her awake. She followed her over to the tray, blinking sleepily.
There are so many things only direct observation can tell us, Montoya said. I told Kivrin to record every detail. I hope there's room on the corridor. It's so small.
She looked at her watch again.
Of course, it had to be.
Did you get a chance to see it before they implanted it?
It really does look like a bone spur.
Bone spur? Dunworthy said, watching the medic's blood spurt into the vial.
That's so it can't cause an anachronism, even if it's discovered. It fits right against the palmar surface of the scaphoid bone.
She rubbed the wrist bone above the thumb.
Mary motioned to Dunworthy, and the medic stood up, rolling down her sleeve. Dunworthy took her place in the chair. Mary peeled the back from a monitor, stuck it to the inside of Dunworthy's wrist, and handed him a temp to swallow.
Have the bursar call me at this number as soon as he returns, Gilchrist said, and hung up.
Montoya snatched up the phone, punched in a number, and said,
Hi, can you tell me the quarantine perimeter? I need to know if Whitney's inside it. My dig's there.
Whoever she was talking to apparently told her no.
Then who can I talk to about getting the perimeter changed? It's an emergency.
They're worried about their emergencies, Dunworthy thought, and neither of them's even given a thought to worrying about Kivrin.
Well, what was there to worry about?
A corridor had been disguised to look like a bone spur so it wouldn't cause an anachronism when the contents decided to chop off her hands before they burned her at the stake.
Mary took his blood pressure and then jabbed him with a punch.
If the phone ever becomes available, she said, slapping on the plaster and motioning to Gilchrist, who was standing next to Montoya looking impatient, you might ring up William Gadsden and warn him that his mother's coming.
Montoya said, Yes, the number for the National Trust,
hung up the phone and scribbled a number on one of the brochures. The phone trilled. Gilchrist, halfway to Mary, launched himself at it, grabbing it up before Montoya could reach it.
No,
he said, and handed it grudgingly over to Dunworthy. It was Finch. He was in the bursar's office.
Have you got Vadrie's medical records?
Dunworthy said.
Yes, sir. The police are here, sir. They're looking for places to put all the detainees who don't live in Oxford.
And they want us to put them up at Balliol? Dunworthy said.
Yes, sir. How many shall I tell them we can take?
Mary had stood up, Gilchrist's vial of blood in hand, and was signaling to Dunworthy.
Wait a minute, please, he said, and punched hold on the mouthpiece.
Are they asking you to board detainees? Mary asked.
Yes, he said.
Don't commit to filling all your rooms, she said,
We may need infirmary space. Dunworthy took his hand away and said,
Tell them we can put them in Fisher and whatever rooms are left in Salvin. If you haven't assigned rooms to the bell ringers, double them up.
Tell the police infirmary has asked for Bulkley Johnson as an emergency ward.
Did you say you'd found Badri's medical records?
Yes, sir. I had the very devil of a time finding them. The bursar had filed them under Badri, Chowdhury, and the Americans.
Did you find his NHS number?
Yes, sir.
I'm putting Dr. Ahrens on,
he said before Finch could launch into tales of the bell ringers. He motioned to Mary.
You can give her the information directly.
Mary attached a plaster to Gilchrist's arm and a temp monitor to the back of his hand.
I got through to Ely, sir, Finch said. I informed them of the handbell concert cancellation, and they were quite pleasant, but the Americans are still very unhappy.
Mary finished entering Latimer's reeds, stripped off the gloves, and came over to take the phone from Dunworthy.
Finch, Dr. Ahrens here. Read me Badri's NHS number.
Dunworthy handed her his secondary's sheet and a pencil, and she wrote it down, and then asked for Badri's inoculation records, and made a number of notations Dunworthy couldn't decipher.
Any reactions or allergies?
There was a pause, and then she said,
All right, no, I can get the rest off the computer. I'll ring you back if I need additional information.
She handed the phone back to Dunworthy. He wants to speak with you again, she said, and left, taking the paper with her.
They're most unhappy at being kept here, Finch said. Miss Taylor is threatening to sue for involuntary breach of contract.
When was Badri's last course of antivirals?
Finch took a considerable time looking through his sheaf of papers.
There it is, sir. September 14th.
Did he have the full course?
Yes, sir. Receptor analogs, MPA booster, and seasonals.
Has he ever had a reaction to an antiviral?
No, sir. There's nothing under allergies in the history. I already told Dr. Ahrens that.
Badri had had all his antivirals. He had no history of reactions.
Have you been to New College yet?
Dunworthy asked.
No, sir, I'm just on my way. What should I do about supplies, sir? We've adequate stores of soap, but we're very low on lavatory paper.
The door opened, but it wasn't Mary. It was the medic who had been sent to fetch Montoya. He went over to the tea trolley and plugged in the electric kettle.
Should I ration the lavatory paper, do you think, sir?
Finch said.
Or put up notices asking everyone to conserve?
Whatever you think best,
Dunworthy said, and rang off. It must still be raining. The medic's uniform was wet, and when the kettle boiled, he put his red hands over the steam as if trying to warm them.
Are you quite finished using the telephone?
Gilchrist said. Dunworthy handed it to him. He wondered what the weather was like where Kivrin was, and whether Gilchrist had had probability compute the chances of her coming through in the rain. Her cloak had not looked especially waterproof, and that friendly traveller who was supposed to come along within 1.6 hours would have holed up in a hostelry or haymow till the roads dried enough to be passable. Dunworthy had taught Kivrin how to make a fire, but she could hardly do so with wet kindling and numb hands. Winters in the 1300s had been cold. It might even be snowing. The little ice age had just begun in 1320, the weather eventually getting so cold that the Thames froze over. The lower temps and erratic weather had played such havoc with the crops that some historians blamed the Black Death horrors on the malnourished state of the peasants. The weather had certainly been bad. In the autumn of 1348, it had rained in one part of Oxfordshire every day from Michaelmas to Christmas. Kivrin was probably lying there on the wet road, half dead from hypothermia. And broken out in a rash, he thought, from her overdoting tutor worrying too much about her. Mary was right. He did sound like Mrs. Gadsden. The next thing he knew, he'd be plunging off into 1320, forcing the doors of the net open like Mrs. Gadsden on the tube, and Kivrin would be as glad to see him as William was going to be to see his mother, and as in need of help. Kivrin was the brightest and most resourceful student he had ever had. She surely knew enough to get in out of the rain. For all he knew, she had spent her last vac with the Eskimos learning to build an igloo. She had certainly thought of everything else, even down to her fingernails. When she had come in to show him her costume, she had held up her hands. Her nails had been broken off, and there were traces of dirt in the cuticles. "I know I'm supposed to be nobility, but rural nobility. And they did a lot of farm chores in between Bayeux tapestries, and East Riding ladies didn't have scissors till the 1600s. So I spent Sunday afternoon in Montoya's dig, grubbing among the dead bodies to get this effect." Her nails had looked dreadful, and utterly authentic. There was obviously no reason to worry about a minor detail like snow. But he couldn't help it. If he could speak to Badri, ask him what he'd meant when he said, "something wrong." Make certain the drop had gone properly, and that there hadn't been too much slippage. He might be able to stop worrying. But Mary had not been able even to get Badri's NHS number till Finch phoned with it. He wondered if Badri was still unconscious, or worse. He got up and went over to the tea trolley and made himself a cup of tea. Gilchrist was on the phone again, apparently speaking to the porter. The porter didn't know where Bevingham was either. When Dunworthy had talked to him, he had told him he thought Bevingham had mentioned Loch Balkillen, a lake that turned out not to exist. Dunworthy drank his tea. Gilchrist rang up the bursar and the deputy warden, neither of whom knew where Bevingham had gone. The nurse who had guarded the door earlier came in and finished the blood test. The male medic picked up one of the inspirational brochures and began to read it. Montoya filled out her admissions form and her list of contacts. "What am I supposed to do?" she asked Dunworthy. "Write down the people I've been in contact with today?"
"The past 3 days," he said.
They continued to wait. Dunworthy drank another cup of tea. Montoya rang up the NHS and tried to persuade them to give her a quarantine exemption so she could go back to the dig. The female medic went back to sleep. The nurse wheeled in a trolley with supper on it.
"Great chair, mard or hostus, ever reach own, on toe the soper setus, unown,"
Latimer said. The only remark he had made all afternoon. While they ate, Gilchrist regaled Latimer with his plans for sending Kivrin to the aftermath of the Black Death.
"The accepted historical view is that it completely destroyed medieval society," he told Latimer, as he cut his roast beef. "But my research indicates it was purgative rather than catastrophic."
From whose point of view, Dunworthy thought, wondering what was taking so long. He wondered if they were truly processing the blood tests, or if they were simply waiting for one or all of them to collapse across the tea trolley so they could get a fix on the incubation period. Gilchrist rang up New College again and asked for Bevingham's secretary.
"She's not there," Dunworthy said. "She's in Devonshire with her daughter for Christmas."
Gilchrist ignored him.
"Yes, I need to get a message through to her. I'm trying to reach Mr. Bevingham. It's an emergency. We've just sent an historian to the 1300s, and Balliol failed to properly screen the tech who ran the net. As a result, he's contracted a contagious virus."
He put the phone down.
If Mr. Child Hurry failed to have any of the necessary antivirals, I'm holding you personally responsible, Mr. Dunworthy.
He had the full course in September, Dunworthy said.
Have you proof of that?
Gilchrist said.
Did it come through?
The medic asked. They all, even Latimer, turned to look at her in surprise. Until she'd spoken, she'd seemed fast asleep, her head far forward on her chest and her arms folded, holding the contacts list.
You said you sent somebody back to the Middle Ages, she said belligerently. Did it?
I'm afraid I don't,
Gilchrist said.
This virus, she said, could it have come through the time machine?
Gilchrist looked nervously at Dunworthy.
That isn't possible, is it?
No, Dunworthy said.
It was obvious Gilchrist knew nothing about the continuum paradoxes or string theory. The man had no business being acting head. He didn't even know how the net he had so blithely sent Kivrin through worked. The virus couldn't have come through the net.
Dr. Arend said the Indian was the only case, the medic said.
And you said, she pointed at Dunworthy, that he'd had the full course. If he's had his antivirals, he couldn't catch a virus, unless it was a disease from somewhere else. And the Middle Ages was full of diseases, wasn't it? Smallpox and the plague.
Gilchrist said, I'm certain that Medieval has taken steps to protect against that possibility.
There is no possibility of a virus coming through the net, Dunworthy said angrily. The space-time continuum does not allow it to happen.
You send people through, he persisted, and a virus is smaller than a person.
Dunworthy hadn't heard that argument since the early years of the net, when the theory was only partially understood.
I assure you we've taken every precaution, Gilchrist said.
Nothing that would affect the course of history can go through a net, Dunworthy explained, glaring at Gilchrist. The man was simply encouraging her with his talk of precautions and probabilities. Radiation, toxins, microbes, none of them has ever passed through a net. If they're present, the net simply won't open.
The medic looked unconvinced.
I assure you, Gilchrist said,
and Mary came in. She was carrying a sheaf of variously coloured papers.
Gilchrist stood up immediately.
Dr. Arendt, is there a possibility that this viral infection Mr. Chowdhury has contracted might have come through the net?
Of course not, she said, frowning as if the whole idea were ridiculous. In the first place, diseases can't come through the net. It would violate the paradoxes. In the second place, if it had, which it can't, Badri would have caught it less than an hour after it came through, which would mean the virus had an incubation period of an hour, an utter impossibility. But if it did, which it can't, you all would be down ill already. She looked at her digital. Since it's been over 3 hours since you were exposed to it. She began collecting the contacts list.
Gilchrist looked irritated. As acting head of the history faculty, I have responsibilities I must attend to, he said. How long do you intend to keep us here?
Only long enough to collect your contacts list, she said, and to give you your instructions.
Perhaps 5 minutes.
She took Latimer's list from him.
Montoya grabbed hers up from the end table and began writing hastily.
5 minutes,
the medic who had asked about the virus coming through the net said.
Do you mean we're free to go?
On medical probation, she said. She put the list at the bottom of her sheaf of papers and began passing the top sheets, which were a virulent pink, around to everyone. They appeared to be a release form of some sort, absolving the infirmary of any and all responsibility.
We've completed your blood tests, she went on, and none of them show an increased level of antibodies. She handed Dunworthy a blue sheet, which absolved the NHS of any and all responsibility and confirmed willingness to pay any and all charges
not covered by the NHS in full and within 30 days. I've been in touch with the WIC, and their recommendation is controlled observation, with continuous febrile monitoring and blood samples at 12-hour intervals. The sheet she was distributing now was green and headed Instructions for Primary Contacts. Number one was, avoid contact with others. Dunworthy thought of Finch and the bell ringers waiting, no doubt, at the gate of Balliol with summons and scriptures, and of all those Christmas shoppers and detainees between here and there. Record your temp at half-hour intervals, she said, passing round a yellow form. Come in immediately if your monitor, she tapped at her own, shows a marked increase in temp. Some fluctuation is normal. Temps tend to rise in the late afternoon and evening. Any temp between 36 and 37.4 is normal. Come in immediately if your temp exceeds 37.4 or rises suddenly. Or if you begin to feel any symptoms, headache, tightness in the chest, mental confusion, or dizziness. Everyone looked at his or her monitor, and no doubt began to feel a headache coming on. Dunworthy had had a headache all afternoon. Avoid contact with others as much as possible, Mary said. Keep careful track of any contacts you do have. We're still uncertain of the mode of transmission, but most myxoviruses spread by droplet and direct contact. Wash your hands with soap and water frequently. She handed Dunworthy another pink sheet. She was running out of colours. This one was a log headed Contacts, and under it, name, address, type of contact, time. It was unfortunate that Badri's virus had not had to deal with the CDC, the NHS, and the WIC. It would never have gotten the door. You must report back here at 7 tomorrow morning. In the meantime, I'd recommend a good supper, and then to bed. Rest is the best defense against any virus. You are off duty, she said, looking at the medics, for the duration of the temp quarantine. She passed out several more rainbow-hued papers, and then asked brightly, any questions? Dunworthy looked at the medic, waiting for her to ask Mary if smallpox had come through the net. But she was looking uninterestedly at her clutch of papers. Can I go back to my dig? Montoya asked. Not unless it's inside the quarantine perimeter, Mary said. Well, great, she said, jamming her papers angrily into the pockets of her terrorist jacket. The whole village will have washed away while I'm stuck here, she stomped out. Are there any other questions? Mary said imperturbably. Very well, then. I'll see you all at 7 o'clock. The medics ambled out, the one who had asked about the virus yawning and stretching, as if she were preparing for another nap. Latimer was still sitting down, watching his temp monitor. Gilchrist said something snappish to him, and he got up and put his coat on, and collected his umbrella and his stack of papers. I expect to be kept informed of every development, Gilchrist said. I am contacting Basingham and telling him it's essential that he return and take charge of this matter. He swept out, and then had to wait, holding the door open for Latimer to pick up two papers he had dropped. Go round in the morning and collect Latimer, won't you? Mary said, looking through the contacts list. You'll never remember he's to be here at 7. I want to see Badri, Dunworthy said. Laboratory Braised Nose, she said, reading from the sheets. Dean's Office Braised Nose. Laboratory Braised Nose. Didn't anyone see Badri except in the net? In the ambulance on the way here, he said, something wrong, Dunworthy said. There could have been slippage. If she's more than a week off, she'll have no idea when to rendezvous. She didn't answer. She sorted through the sheets again, frowning. I need to make certain there weren't any problems with the fix, he said insistently. She looked up. Very well, she said. These contact sheets are hopeless. There are great gaps in Badri's whereabouts for the past 3 days. He's the only person who can tell us where he was and with whom he came in contact. She led the way back down the corridor. I've had a nurse with him asking him questions, but he's so very disoriented and fearful of her. Perhaps he won't be as frightened of you. She led the way down the corridor to the lift and said, "Ground floor, please," into its ear. "Badri is only conscious for a few moments at a time," she said to Dunworthy. "It may be most of the night."
"That's all right," Dunworthy said. "I won't be able to rest, or I'm sure Kivrin is safely through."
They went up two flights in the lift, down another corridor, and through a door marked "No Entrance, Isolation Ward." Inside the door, a grim-looking ward sister was sitting at a desk watching a monitor.
"I'm taking Mr. Dunworthy in to see Mr. Chaudhuri," Mary said. "We'll need SPGs.
How is he?"
"His fever's up again. 39.8, the sister said, handing them the SPGs, which were plastine-sealed bundles of paper clothing gowns that stripped up the back. Caps, imperm masks that were impossible to get on over the caps, booty-like snugs that went on over their shoes, and imperm gloves. Dunworthy made the mistake of putting his gloves on first and took what seemed like hours attempting to unfold the gown and affix the mask.
"You'll need to ask very specific questions," Mary said. "Ask him what he did when he got up this morning. If he'd stayed the night with anyone, where he ate breakfast, who was there, that sort of thing. His high fever means that he's very disoriented. You may have to ask your questions several times." She opened the door to the room. It wasn't really a room. There was only space for the bed and a narrow camp stool, not even a chair. The wall behind the bed was covered with displays and equipment. The far wall had a curtained window and more equipment. Mary glanced briefly at Badri and then began scanning the displays. Dunworthy looked at the screens. The one nearest him was full of numbers and letters. The bottom line read, "ICU 1432069 22-12-54 1803 200/RPT 1800 CRS IMJPCLN 200MG/Q6H NHS 40-211-7 M. Arons." Apparently the doctor's orders. The other screens showed spiking lines and columns of figures. None of them made any sense, except for a number in the middle of the small display second from the right. It read, "Temp, 39.9. Dear God. He looked at Badri. He was lying with his arms outside the bedclothes, his arms both connected to drips that hung from stanchions. One of the drips had at least 5 bags feeding into the main tube. His eyes were closed, and his face looked thin and drawn, as if he had lost weight since this morning. His dark skin had a strange purplish cast to it. "Badri," Mary said, leaning over him, "can you hear us?" He opened his eyes and looked at them without recognition, which was probably due less to the virus than to the fact that they were covered from head to foot in paper. "It's Mr. Dunworthy," Mary said helpfully. "He's come to see you." Her bleeper started up.
"Mr. Dunworthy?"
he said hoarsely and tried to sit up. Mary pushed him gently down into the pillow. "Mr. Dunworthy has some questions for you," she said, patting his chest gently, the way she had in the laboratory at Brazenose. She straightened up, watching the displays on the wall behind him. "Lie still. I need to leave now, but Mr. Dunworthy will stay with you. Rest and try to answer Mr. Dunworthy's questions." She left.
"Mr. Dunworthy,"
Badri said again, as if he were trying to make sense of the words.
"Yes,"
Dunworthy said. He sat down on the camp stool.
How are you feeling?
When do you expect him back?
Badri said, and his voice sounded weak and strained. He tried to sit up again. Dunworthy put out his hand to stop him.
Have to find him, he said. There's something wrong.
This ends side two of cassette three of Doomsday Book. Please fast forward to the end before loading cassette four.